Welcome, listeners, to A Writer's Life. I'm your host, Heike Bohm, the author of the novel Secrets in the Shadows. A Writer's Life is a place where I'll be in conversation with fellow writers. We'll discuss all things writing, they'll read from their latest works, and we'll explore what happens beyond the pen in A Writer's Life. It's gonna be a page-turner. I just know it. Pull up a chair and join us. I'm recording on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Squamish Nation. Welcome, listeners, to another episode of A Writer's Life. I'm thrilled to be in conversation today with Megan Hakkinen. Megan Hakkinen is a writer, an ultra-endurance cyclist from British Columbia's west coast. Her two-wheel adventures have taken her from Haida Gwaii to Mexico's high plateaus, across Canada and the United States, and North Cape of Tarifa along some of Europe's highest paved roads. Megan is a Trans Am Bike Race North Cape 4000 and a Paris-Brest, Paris-Brevet finisher, as well as the 2019 24-hour World Time Trial Champion and current course record holder in the women's division. Megan's writing explores relationships, experiences on the road, and encounters with wild places. She's the author of South Away, the Pacific Coast on Two Wheels, published by New West Press in 2019. Finalist of the 2020 Kobo Emerge Writers Prize Nonfiction, as well as 2020 Alberta Book Publishing Award Trade Nonfiction. Megan has an MFA in writing from the University of Saskatchewan and lives on the traditional ancestral unceded territory of the Siksik Okanagan people in the Okanagan Valley. Welcome, Megan.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Where were you born and what was it like around your dinner table when you were growing up?
I was born in Vancouver, BC, and I grew up in Surrey. And our dinner table kind of went through different stages, I guess. I have a younger sister. When we were kids, we were bratty and didn't want to eat our meals and probably drove my parents crazy. And then as we got older, I got really into sports. So I was hungry all the time and I would eat anything that was put in front of me and my sister's leftovers and whatever was left in the pot. And then my mother and sister became vegetarian, I guess when we were in our teens. And my sister and I were busy with after school activities and sports. So no more family dinners, but still really good nourishing food. And yeah, she stopped cooking meat for my father and I and said if we wanted to make it, we could cook up chicken on our own. And we were both too lazy or busy. So we kind of were vegetarians in the home as well. Yeah.
What sort of conversations would you have around the dinner table?
We spent a lot of time talking about what we did at school. My parents were really big on education and were always curious, you know, what we were up to in school and what we were working on, what kind of projects and stuff. And we had a pretty vibrant after school life, a lot of running around in the forest and making forts and having little like wars with our friends and tell some of those stories, but probably not all of them because we get in trouble for, you know, revealing that we had jumped the neighbor's fence and like those types of things. My father worked pretty long hours and sometimes he would fall asleep in the car in the driveway before he came in the house. And my mom would have dinner ready and look out in the driveway and see him sleeping and be like, go and get your father. And I'd be like, oh, I feel so bad waking up someone who's that tired that they can't even like get in the house after work.
What got you interested in cycling?
I was going to school at Simon Fraser University. My commute was really, really long. And I lived in Surrey. And the first, I guess, semester or two, I borrowed my mom's car and drove. And would always be trying to find free parking on campus. And then I couldn't find any more free parking. So I was taking transit, and it was like an hour and a half, an hour and 45 minutes from my house. And it seemed like a lot of time wasted. So I started commuting by bike for part of that to kind of get some activity in my day and just, you know, be outside in nature. And that happened the same time that I had a knee injury from snowboarding. And my physio suggested I take up cycling to kind of help rehabilitate my knee and strengthen it. And so that fulfilled my desire to be, you know, doing activity, because I couldn't, you know, I couldn't play soccer or anything. I had to be a little more gentle. And then from there, it just took off. That was in my early 20s. And I realized how quickly you can get places by bike, how efficient it is. I had a junky bike I got from Play It Again Sports for like $50 and some cheap fenders and a cheap lock. And I rode that bike everywhere. And remember the first time I hit train tracks on it, I didn't understand you had to have the wheel perpendicular to the tracks. And I just, like, it was a yard sale. I ate it so hard and scraped myself up and showed up for class with these like little band-aids on my arms. And, you know, I was late and my teacher just looked at me and I was like, just so scruffy looking and scuffed up. And I don't think I've made that mistake on train tracks again, though. I approach them with much more caution.
Good call. The most intense outdoor activity I've done was hike the Stein Valley for 7 days. And I spent about a month planning for that trip. How long did it take you to plan your long distance bike trips? And what goes into your planning?
The planning takes a while, and a lot of it is just kind of daydreaming and thinking about what you'd like to do. And then there's the more practical, like, this is what I actually need, and this is how I'm going to go about getting it, whether it's ordering it online or going to a bike shop and or learning a new skill set. So for the bike trip that I wrote about in South Away, I had started planning it maybe 10 months out, and then the last 2 months, I kind of planned more seriously. Even then, there was a lot of stuff I didn't consider at all or didn't know to consider, because when you're doing something for the first time, you don't really know what you're doing. And yeah, and I didn't have internet at the time, so it's a little harder to look stuff up.
What struck you most about your trip to Haida Gwaii, Europe, Mexico, and the Pacific Coast?
Oh man, that's like a huge question. I think that I really love to arrive in a new place on a bicycle, and the world just kind of opens up to you, and you have so many directions to take it. You can, you know, ride off into the woods. You can follow the road to the end of a peninsula. You can, you know, take your bike to the museum and check out the culture and those types of aspects. But I think the feeling of possibility and discovery that I get from arriving in a new place by bike, it just feels like anything could happen. And that's such an exciting feeling. I think it's something that we feel a lot as children, maybe. And as adults, we kind of maybe step into the humdrum daily lives. And it's not bad, but it's not exciting either.
Is there anything of, say, Haida Gwaii that really stands out for you when you were there?
Yeah, so I arrived there in September, and it's kind of an iffy time to travel because it's a very wet place. But I also think that it's a beautiful time to see the islands. I think what stuck out to me was beach camping on these deserted, windy, kind of these windy beaches, and just seeing either the stones or the sand and all the windswept trees, and just feeling very alone in a place that was quiet from human voices, but noisy with the sounds of nature, you know, ravens and eagles. And you could imagine the life that was going on around you, I think, you know, in the oceans and in the forests. And I didn't spend much time in the town, so I didn't have very much contact with people. And whenever I did, it was just a joy to kind of, you know, chit chat with someone for a few minutes. I cycled there with a fellow from the Kootenays that I met on the ferry. And so it was cool to get to know him as well in that kind of environment, where it was just the two of us kind of riding along together as newfound friends and, you know, discussing our lives and our friends' past things we had done. Yeah, so it was a really cool experience altogether.
What was it like traveling in Mexico? Because it would be so much different than here.
Yeah, kind of the opposite end of the coast. I really enjoyed cycling in Mexico. And I won't say it was like amazing cycling because we were on the highway. There's a lot of big trucks and stuff passing you. But as you go south further, there's less truck traffic and less vehicles. And the landscape starts to change from Tijuana, where it's more of this kind of busy city with potholes and road hazards and lots of traffic and stuff and smells. And then you kind of reach this more barren landscape, and then the cactus just take over, and they're so strange and beautiful, and the sunsets were outstanding. Again, I think that sense of discovery and potential to kind of learn something about a new place was just so high on my mind. And yeah, it was pretty exciting.
Nice. How did you navigate Europe and what really stuck with you from there?
The first time I went to Europe, I guess I've been three times, once with three friends after high school, and we just went to London and explored, and it was really cool, and a bunch of 18-year-old girls. It was pretty exciting. Kind of being chaperoned, my friend's mom was with us a lot of the time. And then
bummer.
I know. We went to the residence of Sherlock Holmes and just a lot of cool places like that. And the second time I went with a friend that I had met cycling across America, and he was from Germany, and we were going to ride this bike race called the North Cape Tarifa Adventure. And it's like a 7,300 kilometer ride from North Cape, Norway to Tarifa, Spain. And so it's a pretty epic journey. So I had him kind of showing me the ropes and how to navigate the streets. And I wasn't so confident riding in Europe, and I didn't realize that. I thought it would be easy. You know, it's not the wrong side of the road or anything, but I just didn't understand roundabouts. I found myself really stressed out trying to navigate. And I think my head just kind of exploded a bit. And so he really helped me kind of find my way. And we actually scratched from the race when we arrived in Bregenz, Austria, because we were both so fatigued and worn down. And we decided to stop racing and just tour. And so we entered the Alps in kind of a slower manner and had a really great time. We had a chance to actually, you know, enjoy ourselves and sleep a lot more and stop earlier in the day if we found like a cute little hotel that we wanted to stay in, and go swimming whenever it struck us. And when race mode, really committed to making forward progress at whatever cost. And touring was a lot more enjoyable, especially since I'd never been to these types of places. You know, we were in Nice and Cannes. I probably pronounced that wrong because I'm such an anglophone, but it was just great to get to experience everything at a slower pace. And we actually didn't really do kind of museums or any of those cultural things, because it is a bit harder when you have a bicycle with you. And, you know, you could get around that by leaving it at someone's house, but I definitely wouldn't want to leave my bike outside of a place for too long. So I guess I always feel like I can go back, and I hope to go back in the future and see some of the things I didn't before. And then I went back to Europe, I guess, in 2019. And I went back on my own to race in another event. And I was much more confident. And I think it was because I had somebody kind of help me out a bit before. And I was able to navigate on my own without freaking out when I hit a huge roundabout, or if I got lost in a city, I could get myself unlost. So it did take me a little bit of time, but I guess I'm really proud of the fact that I can navigate self-sufficiently now.
What got you into racing? What inspired you to do that?
I've always been a competitive person, and I think I just needed a competitive sport as an adult. I played roller derby for a few years when I lived in Vancouver, and I loved it. It's such a great activity. I met so many wonderful people and just really got to dig into my competitive side. But then I blew out my other knee, and I have had two ACL surgeries and three ACL tears. And I just thought that contact sports were not a wise decision for me anymore, because I was already into cycle touring and cycle commuting. Once I kind of heard about ultra distance bike packing races, it kind of sparked my curiosity. And I thought, because I love being on my bike anyways, it might be kind of an opportunity for me to be competitive and do something I love. And then I might actually be good in it because I've had so much experience touring. So the first event I entered was the Trans Am bike race, and that's a 6,900 kilometer race from Astoria, Oregon, to Yorktown, Virginia. So it's kind of a big event to get your feet wet in. But, you know, getting ready for that race and preparing for it and everything, it was just such an exciting time for me. And I really am glad that I decided to go big.
You know, what I take away from what you've just said and sharing that story with us is don't be afraid of trying new things. And that leads me to the next question. What got you into writing, and what was your first piece you had published?
I always wrote as a kid. I loved like journal hour in school, and I was always making stories up about my pet rabbits. And a lot of them were pretty cliched. I was basically stealing from other books that I read, but I think that there were some sparks of creativity in there. Cycling actually is really what prompted me to write more. So when I was cycling across Canada, I kept a blog, and I would, you know, update every couple of days. I'd stop into a library and use their computers to, you know, post a few photos and write what I'd been up to. And I had such enthusiastic responses from friends and family and people I didn't know. And they, you know, they seemed to really enjoy reading about my experience. And I wanted to develop my skill in writing so that I could better translate these amazing things that were happening to me on the road onto paper or onto the screen so that I could, you know, better tell my story, I guess. So after I finished that trip across Canada, I went to Kwantlen. I'd already graduated from university in archaeology, but I took some classes at Kwantlen in writing, and I think I started out with distance, and then I took a few in person, and I was just really, really excited to learn more about the craft and have an opportunity to take classes just because I wanted to. You know, they, you know, weren't leading anywhere at that time. And my first piece was called Blueberry Inn, and it was published in the Kwantlen like Students Arts Journal or something. And it was a story kind of vaguely autobiographical, but fiction about going to one of the Gulf Islands with my dad as a kid and kind of hanging around as he was doing work on the telephone system. I can't actually remember any of the plot, but I don't, maybe there wasn't a plot. I don't know. I think it had good bits to it, but I feel like the plot was definitely a weakness. Yeah, and I had a prof there who encouraged me to complete an MFA in writing. And I was like, what? You want me to go back to school full time? Like, I'm working. I have a job. And she just said that she thought I would really enjoy it. And, you know, why not? And she would be happy to write me a reference letter. And I guess that's all it took. I started applying to schools, and I got into the University of Saskatchewan's MFA in writing program and moved there to complete it. So, yeah, thanks, Jenny.
When I would go driving to our swimming pool up here when it was open before COVID, it's about a half hour drive. And during that drive, I start to think about this one novel that I'm writing called Sweetwater. I don't know what it is, but that story constantly unfolds as I'm driving. Does that happen to you when you're traveling on your bike? As in, does story unfold as you are writing? Do you get those moments of, oh my God, this will be so good? And you formulate that thought and that story in your mind and can't wait to sit down and actually write it?
Yes, you have basically expressed what happens to me when I'm in a creative mood and cycling as well. I think that there's something happens like when you're driving or when I'm cycling or when you're sitting around drinking your cup of coffee in the morning, and you know, that act of being bored and having your mind kind of have that freedom of movement is something that we don't get as much maybe these days with our phones in our pockets all the time and having really stimulated lives and lots of stuff on the go. So for me, cycling is a chance to kind of, I don't want to say unproductively creative, but, you know, I don't have a pen and paper in front of me. I'm just able to think and kind of play around with ideas and see where my mind goes. And you don't know what's going to come to you. And it's really exciting. And the problem is if you have a great idea and you have to stop and write it down. And so I'm like passionately hacking away at my phone's keypad, trying to spit out whatever is in my mind so I don't forget it. So I'm going to learn how to use the dictate function. I think that would be much quicker and more direct than, you know, trying to type it with my thumbs on my phone. But I do think that being able to go for a walk or a bike ride, it's a great way of kind of getting the ideas rolling and moving. And there's something about movement of the body and movement of your thoughts that, you know, they kind of go hand in hand sometimes. And I think it's exciting. You never know what you're going to be surprised with. And it's a different way of thinking about things. And it's I'm glad you can use your drives productively and have those kind of experiences.
Thanks. I think what it is that quiet time. There's no other distractions and it gives space for your mind to wander, which leads me to your book. Would you delight our listeners with a reading from your book, South Away, The Pacific Coast on Two Wheels, published by New West Press in 2019?
Yeah, definitely. So this is a section from Chapter 10, titled Redwood Green, from Crescent City to Mendocino, California. So it takes place midpoint in the story, and I'm riding with my sister and a fellow named Zach that we picked up in Corvallis. The bark of harbor sea lions fades from earshot as we ride past Crescent City limits. Mottled sunlight sparkles through cracks of deep green as I shift blue steel, that's my bicycle, into a low gear and dig in for the climb. Zach pinballs between me and Alicia, all enthusiasm and boyish glee. We had crossed the California-Oregon border earlier in the day, wheeling through farmlands towards Crescent City, where we pulled in for a round of diner coffee before tackling the trio of hills that will lead us into the California Redwoods. Known as the North Coast or Redwood Empire, this 375-mile stretch of barely populated coastline sits between San Francisco and us. When the hill shows no sign of a summit, Zach settles, the distance between us stretching out like a fading cord. Why are we doing this again? Already, I wish we were back in the diner, surrounded by the buzz of activity and clattering dishware. Maple leaves, big as lampshades, tumble from above, crumpling under our tires with a satisfying crackle. The groan of hill-weary motorhomes resonates in my chest, and I'm relieved that we're not the only ones struggling. Oregon was the state of cates. California, we're told, the golden state, the land of milk, or marijuana, as we'll soon discover, and honey. With 840 miles of coastline, it's the third largest state in America. Home to 1 in 8 U.S. citizens, as well as Redwood Groves and Steinbeck's Cannery Row, plus miles of SoCal surfers' paradise. But it is San Francisco that we spend our nights dreaming of, the three of us swept up in its aura, its promise of new experience. Unlike the mill towns and seaside communities of the Pacific Northwest, San Fran is no decimal point on the map, but a full-fledged city, a lifestyle, a place we know about from books and rumors and episodes of Full House, where fearless bike couriers shred one-way streets and aging hippies hawk tie-dye on Haight-Ashbury. Zach has an uncle in San Pablo, just outside of San Francisco, and so we ride with anticipation, every mile marker a step closer to the city by the bay. By lunchtime, we begin to experience the payoff from strenuous uphills when we arrive in Redwood State Park, home to some of the tallest and oldest trees on the planet. This is the domain of giants. Redwoods taller than Vancouver's business district office towers, a canopy of bird call boardroom meetings and squirrel executives, trunks reminiscent of fortress walls edge both sides of the highway, and the scent of decomposing foliage, acrid and tangy, lifts from the understory. We are Lego figures on wheels in this landscape of thousand-year-old evergreens, this forest moon of Endor. Return to the Jedi was filmed here. My diminishing energy redoubles when I realize that we're pedaling into the same woods where Han, Luke, and Leia were received by the Ewoks' treetop village. The Redwood landscape takes on a sci-fi feel, Our quest to reach San Francisco suddenly is crucial to humanity as the Rebel Alliance's mission to destroy the Death Star's shield generator. Well, it was my father who introduced me to sci-fi. My mother was the one who insisted that we go, just she and I, to see A New Hope when it was re-released for the franchise's 20th anniversary. This was 1997, 2 years before Jar Jar Binks would become a loathed household name. I'd never seen any of the Star Wars trilogy, didn't know my mother was even a fan, and I'm not sure why it was just the two of us. Perhaps Alicia wasn't interested. Perhaps Dad had hockey practice. It wasn't spur of the moment either. She set a date, a Friday night. We arrived early to beat the crowds, a bag of popcorn doused in butter, and a Rolo to share between us. I adored every minute of it. From the streaming opening text to Princess Leia's cinnamon bun hair rolls to the Rebels' final X-Wing attack on the Death Star, I was captivated. I knew you'd love it, my mother had said when we shouldered our way through the crowd, out of the cinema and into the parking lot. I totally called it. How did you know? I had said, still in a buttery haze. The afterglow of Luke's lightsaber was slicing through my thoughts like the car light stabbing darkness around us. I remember how I felt when I first saw it, she had said. I knew you'd feel the same. It had scared me that she could look inside me so easily, know exactly what I desired, what I craved, some Jedi mind trick. And still, like the time she painted a house raspberry reds and sunflower yellow while Alicia and I were away camping with our father, I wondered what I actually knew about her. What were her interests? My father, he was easy to pin down, an open book. He played hockey like an addict, took us to the ski hill nearly every weekend in the winter, and always had some backyard project on the go. My mother, on the other hand, seemed to lack any passion aside from gardening until she quit smoking and became a Canucks fan. She used her cigarette money to buy Pavel Bure jerseys and home game tickets and made a cake in anticipation of their 1994 Stanley Cup win against the New York Rangers. We let it sit in the fridge for 5 days after they lost. The sad truth is, I'd often assume my mother was just boring, a woman without interests, a mother. But after that night, she took me to see A New Hope. My 12-year-old self was forced to reconsider. I wondered as we drove home from the theater if it was possible that my mother used to be cool. Perhaps I'd misjudged her, and the reason she didn't seem to do anything had more to do with a 40-hour work week and chaperoning her two kids around than anything else. Thinking about it now, it strikes me that she's always been an avid reader, devouring paperback classics and never discouraged, like I've been, by the tiny, near illegible font or the book's refusal to stay open when you set it down on the table. She still loves those stories, like she loves Star Wars. Perhaps in the imaginations of Charles Dickens and Jane Austen, she found a freedom, a quiet escape from 5 a.m. start times and the tedium of motherhood.
That was really, really beautiful.
Thank you. I loved it.
Way to go. What does your mom, or how does she feel now that you've published? Because it sounds like in what you were just reading, she actually is an avid reader. What does she say to you that you're a published author?
She's really excited and proud for me. And I often say that she's my biggest cheerleader because she's always encouraging me to write and, you know, asking me what I'm working on, just like those dinner time conversations when I was a kid. Her thoughts towards this book are very positive, but her first reading of it was not so positive because I kind of I talk a lot about our personal family kind of relationships and some of my frustration in our relationship. And, you know, I wrote all this stuff and then I didn't let her read it. And then I found a publisher and I was like, oh man, I got to show it to her now. And so on the one hand, she's thrilled that her daughter's going to be a published author. On the other hand, you know, it kind of showcases, I don't know, I guess it's kind of, yeah, opening up the curtain in our own family life a bit and just, you know, being okay with that. And I think it's a challenge that nonfiction writers, you know, always face is portraying loved ones. Yeah. In general, she's really encouraging and super positive. And she's always, you know, she's always telling me, you're a great author, Megan. You've got to keep writing. You've always got to keep writing. And I think that's what people need sometimes. It's just someone who's consistently, you know, behind you and just telling you to keep going, to keep doing it. And, you know, she doesn't necessarily critique my work. That's not her job. And I'm just happy to have her prompting me, I guess, all the time.
Wonderful. What does a typical day of writing look like for you?
So I like to get up later on my days off, which are my writing days, and that's usually about 8:30, and I enjoy a cup of coffee, and I like to read for about an hour to warm up my mind. I find that I'm just not super fresh in the morning, and I like to treat myself to that coffee and reading break. And I start it with free writing usually, especially if I don't quite know what I'm doing, just the no pressure opportunity to spend, you know, I'll set a timer for 20 minutes and free write about, and that always kind of gets my mind going. And I feel much more confident. I realize that I do have something to say, and I always find something in there that I really like. If I'm working on a project, I usually set myself kind of time goals and say, oh, you're going to write for 2 to 4 hours, and then do this task or activity or chore that you have to complete, and then, you know, come back and see where you're at. But I like to be a little bit organized. Otherwise, I find time kind of just disappears. And, you know, whether it's me maybe checking my social media too much or kind of spiraling down some small insignificant part of my work that doesn't require this level of attention. So I do like to have either time goals or page goals. And yeah, I think I struggle with, you know, trying to get everything perfect the first time I'm putting it down on the computer keypad. And I think it's better just to spit out your ideas and go back and rework them. At least that's what's been successful for me. And sometimes the stuff that comes out of you right away is actually better than you think it is. And that's really encouraging.
What does a day look like for you training for a bike tour or a race?
On my regular work days, I train in the evenings after work, usually from 8 until 10 p.m. And then I go to bed at like 10:30. It's pretty much directly from the indoor trainer to the shower to the refrigerator to bed. And on my days when I can, you know, train at any time, I usually do my workouts in the middle of the day, kind of around my writing. And if I have a longer ride in the summer, I like to leave really early, like 5 a.m. Right now, I'll wait until 10 or 12 because it's a bit cooler in the morning still. And I would rather just wait until things warm up. Yesterday, I did a century ride. So that's 160 kilometers or 100 miles. And I think I left at noon and I got home at 8. And I, just rode around Kelowna, West Kelowna. Didn't have to go too far to get those miles in and have a bit of an adventure as well.
Any advice you have for wannabe cyclists of distance and racing? And any advice you have for people who want to embark on becoming a writer?
I think for cyclists and writing, I would say just do it. I think I heard one of your other podcast interviewees, Jen Ashton,
yes,
say that for writing, you know, you just got to do it. And I think the same is true for cycling. It is important to plan ahead a bit. You know, if you're heading out down some farm road, you know, you've got to make sure you have enough water with you, like, and enough snacks so that you're not bonking by the time you get home. But I think it's better to, you know, maybe ride your bike and create challenging, interesting rides for yourself, then wait for an event to come up to register in, for instance, especially in these times. I think it's better just to go ahead and create your own challenges and create your own rides instead of waiting around for an opportunity to present itself, because you don't know when that might be. And there's a lot of fun in kind of creating your own adventures. I think that there are similarities, because there's a bit of planning that I would like to do in both. You know, I like to outline my work and writing. I like to create a route and download it onto my bike computer and follow it for my long bike rides. But I would also, you know, say that I'm not afraid to maybe veer off course a little bit, or if there's another road that appears a bit more exciting, I'm not afraid to take that road instead. And same with writing. Sometimes you go into your work with, you know, this idea of what this is what it's going to look like. And then as your creative, you know, juices are flowing. I don't like that phrase, but as your creativity is moving, you realize that, hey, this is something else. Like, this is another direction I could take things. Like, let's see where that goes. So I think there's a lot of opportunities in both cycling writing to kind of, you know, explore and have fun and be playful and see where it takes you. And I guess would say that for cycling, it does help to be more prepared, especially if you're going to, you know, do ultra racing where there's a high stress level and an opportunity to encounter any number of weather conditions and terrain challenges. So kind of knowing what's ahead and how you anticipate dealing with it, like what your sleep setup is, where your refuel stops are, those things are all very, very useful. But not being afraid and plunging right in is great as well.
Are you planning a cycling trip right now? And if so, where?
I had a lot of plans for 2020 and then they got pushed to 2021. And I think they're getting pushed to 2022 at this point. I'd registered for an event called the Transcontinental Bike Race, and it's a race across Europe and it's self-supported between checkpoints. And the checkpoints are usually on mountaintops, and the route changes every year. So 2020 was supposed to start in Brest, France, and go to Burgas, Bulgaria. And then COVID happened, and then they changed the route a little bit this year. But I really don't think travel restrictions will ease in time for that for me in July. So I look forward to planning a lot of cool routes in the Okanagan. I actually just got an off-road bike. So I hope to kind of explore all the logging roads and the rail trails and just kind of, there's a lot of places to kind of get out and explore, and a lot of great campsites, rec sites that are free, little lakes with a few fish in them and a fire pit. So I think that's kind of what I'm going to be doing this summer. We'll just be planning local rides that both challenge me and, you know, allow me to explore some new places. I just bought some bear spray, so I'm ready for anything, man.
We just actually had a bear in our backyard. They always come around this time of year, and he was huge. Oh. And I thought, ooh, great. We need to put up that fence. And they walk right across my deck as well. So air spray is good. Yeah. Yeah. Are you working on any new writing?
Yeah, I'm really excited that I was a recipient of BC Arts Council grant. And so I've been able to, you know, take some time off work and work on editing a manuscript I have. And that manuscript is about competing in the 2017 Trans Am Bike Race. The race where I met the German fellow that I mentioned earlier, and it was just a really exciting, challenging experience for me. So I've been editing that. So it's not quite new writing, although, you know, I've inserted some paragraphs and made some more substantial changes. But it's been just a joy to be able to spend more time with my work. And I feel like I'm always juggling my day job and my writing and my cycling, and I can't seem to manage to balance my life between all three. It's one or two of those things, and you know, one of them usually takes over, and then I don't have time for the other one. So to be able to focus more on writing and prioritize that, it's been awesome. I'm super grateful.
Nice. Yeah, sounds like you're finding a balance, Megan. It was a delight to talk to you today. I'm really excited, and I think I might dust off my mountain bike downstairs and start cycling more. So thank you for that inspiration.
But well, call me up if you. Oh,
sorry. I will. I don't know if I can keep up with you though.
Well, if you ever have any questions or anything, I'm happy to share any insights. My mechanical skills are a little poor though, so hopefully if someone local to help you out with that.
Well, thanks for that offer. I love talking to you, and completely inspired by what you're doing. Thank you so much for coming on A Writer's Life.
Oh, gosh. Say thanks for having me.
That was Megan Hakkinen talking about growing up, cycling, racing, and her fabulous book, South Away, The Pacific Coast on Two Wheels, published by New West Press 2019. For more information about her and her book, where to purchase it, please check the links below. And while you're at it, why not subscribe to A Writer's Life? And if you want more information about myself and my novel Secrets in the Shadows, visit my website at www.heigebohm.ca. For a kinder world, take care of each other.